everyone is heterosexual. The idea that some people are naturally homosexual or naturally gay is just a social construct. So when you have an individual who has same-sex attraction, we see it as something went wrong developmentally. And we try to resolve the issue and put them back on the path toward their natural heterosexuality. That's the philosophy of it.
That's Joseph Nicolosi. He's a leader in the so-called treatment of homosexuality from his clinic here in Encino. But he and therapists like him may have to find a new specialty. President Obama today is calling for the end of this kind of therapy because of its potentially devastating psychological effects. The White House says he won't call for a federal law banning therapists from using these therapies, but will support state bans. So far, though, only California, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. have banned gay conversion therapy for minors. We have two guests on the line now to talk about conversion therapy. Clinton Anderson is a psychologist and director of the LGBT office at the American Psychological Association. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Matthew Shurka. Very nice to have you. Matthew Shurka is an anti-conversion therapy activist. He came out to his parents when he was 15 and went through 5 years of conversion therapy in four different states. He's 26 years old now and he's on the line. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Matthew. And what did you think of the president's announcement?
Utter shock. I cried for 20 minutes and then I laughed for 20 minutes and I was just overwhelmed. It's very moving to see the president make such an announcement on something we've been working on for years.
So it was a surprise that he made this announcement?
Well, we knew that he was going to be some kind of announcement, but it would be made. We just didn't know when or how it was going to occur. And that was the part that was surprising. And seeing it as a news alert on my phone was just, it was a moment to remember.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about your experience with conversion therapy. Your father got you into it, I understand, when you were a teenager.
Yeah, so I came out at 16. I told this, my father was the first person I told, and I thought I was jumping the biggest hurdle that I had to go through. And my father was loving and supportive, and he said he'll, you know, support me in any way I need. But he started to have his fears within like literally about a week or so. And he started to research therapists in the New York area, which is where I'm from. And he came across a licensed therapist who practiced conversion therapy and told him that there is no such thing as homosexuality. And that because I was so young and inexperienced sexually, that I would be, you know, easy cure, an easy fix. It shouldn't take long, and I should see results in as early as 6 weeks, is what the therapist told my father. And so I began. That's when I began at 16 while I was a high school student, and it lasted 5 years.
Hmm. And did you want to go, or were you going because your father made you go?
I was terrified. You know, no one. When someone says they force you, some minors have been forced. No one, you know, tied my hands and took me. But, you know, when your father's telling you that, listen, if you come out, life's going to be really terrible, you know, and I have now a university professor who's telling me the horrors of what it's like to be a gay man, and someone's giving me the option of not coming out to my peers in my high school. Yeah, I thought it was saving my life by taking the therapy. I was very outspoken, knew that I was attracted to other boys at the time. I don't want to say boys, I'm attracted to men, but I was terrified. I trusted and loved my father, and I thought he had my best interest at heart, and I was going to do anything to make sure that I wasn't going to lose my father.
And so what happened in the therapy?
So the therapy is based on the idea that, one, they don't believe in homosexuality, that it doesn't exist. It's just a psychological condition. And it starts with a trauma. Something happens in a childhood trauma that creates a psychological void specifically in their masculinity. So in my case, I didn't have a trauma. I came from a very close-knit family. I grew up in a Jewish suburb. We weren't very religious. But I didn't really have any traumas as a kid. And the belief is when the teenage boy becomes a teenager, this void becomes sexualized. And teenage boys who are experiencing same-sex attraction go after gay sex or the so-called gay lifestyle as a way to fill the void, and they're not actually gay. So when this was explained to me, the first process in curing this was I had to spend as much time with other boys as possible and stay away from women as much as possible. The reason I had to stay away from women was not to learn effeminate behaviors, to keep women as the mysterious opposite sex that I would one day go after in my heterosexual life, and to saturate myself with male bonding, and they call it so-called healthy male bonding, as a way to regain my masculinity and be one of the guys. So unfortunately, I mean, I was estranged from my mother and my sisters for 3 years in this process. I wasn't allowed to speak to them. And that was very hard to manage because they were still physically in my life, and I had to fight the communication off as guided in by my therapist.
Mm-hmm. And was your mom okay with that?
No. So she, in the beginning, you know, both my parents felt naive. They didn't know anyone gay or anyone in their community to talk to, and that's why they had a licensed state practitioner talk to them. And my mom went along with it. She saw maybe there is something to this. And just within maybe a few weeks to a month, she started to disagree. No, what therapy out there exists that separates a child and its mother? However, my father was the one who wanted it. And however much she would actually try to talk to me. And because I thought this was life or death, and I was working so hard that every time she would try to talk to me, I became the police officer in my own home. I blamed her for making me gay because of the therapy, explained that. And I believed it was my mother that caused it. So I became the police officer, and I was the one throwing a tantrum at her every time she even attempted to speak at me, because this is something that I was saving my life over.
Yeah.
That's how I viewed it. So you ask my mom, my mother would say that she lost a child for 3 years, and no matter what she said, she couldn't get me to communicate back to her.
Let's bring in Clinton Anderson now, psychologist with the American Psychological Association. How common is Matthew's story, his experience?
Well, I don't really think we know how common it is. Certainly within communities, particularly religious communities, there are cases that are reported frequently. But having any sense of statistics prevalence, we just really don't have that information.
So you're saying that it's more common in religious households, or?
I actually have a stat for that.
Uh-huh.
We have a study at the National Center for Lesbian Rights based in San Francisco with a study that I can't name the exact study now, but it's a study that we have on file, which is accessible in our Born Perfect campaign. We strongly believe that it's one in three LGBT people have experienced some form of conversion therapy.
Hmm. So some form, it could be from not necessarily a licensed psychologist, but maybe a priest?
A priest, rabbi, imam, licensed therapist, teacher, where someone is trying to change their sexuality.
Yeah. And Clinton Anderson, the American Psychology Association, the APA, is against this, I assume.
Yes, we don't think there's scientific evidence to support it. And as Matthew's case clearly illustrates, we think there's a lot of evidence that it causes harm.
And so when did the mental health establishment decide to come out forcefully against this and say that it actually causes harm? Because for many years, homosexuality was considered a disease in the DSM.
Yes. Well, actually, the first DSM was in the early 50s, and so the change of the mental health classification for homosexuality was in the early 70s. So it's now been longer that it hasn't been in the DSM than it was in the DSM. So as soon as the idea of homosexuality being a disorder was scientifically rejected, the idea that therapy to change sexual orientation was appropriate was also rejected. That, of course, like any practice within a profession, I think has had to slowly develop credibility because there were still very strong voices supporting it. But until maybe the late 80s, early 90s, it was on a clear downward trend. But I think then, as certain practitioners from a religious perspective began to really articulate their positions, such as Dr. Nicolosi, that's when we began to see an increase again and a more assertive media presence from certain individuals and organizations supporting the therapy.
So you don't have an idea of how many psychologists, licensed psychologists, are offering this therapy nationwide?
No, we do not have any idea of that. But I would assume it's a pretty small number. But I know that there are some because Dr. Nicolosi himself is one of them.
And he's still practicing this therapy?
Well, as far as I know, I have not, you know, been aware of his work for the last couple of years, but I assume so.
Yeah.
The answer to that is yes, because Vice News did a documentary piece, as we just heard it actually in the beginning of this segment, which was only filmed in the last couple of months, and he admittedly talks about doing conversion therapy, even though it's been banned from minors in California. That is something he still practices on. And he's playing with words because he says that he's not doing conversion therapy because he says there's no such thing as homosexuality. He says, I'm not in the business of changing people. They already are straight. And he's walking on eggshells with that because it is banned in the state of California, and he's admittedly speaking about practicing conversion therapy on minors in Los Angeles.
But it does raise the issue that it might be difficult to ban it because it might be difficult to define or enforce in the privacy of a doctor's office. What is gay conversion therapy versus just talk therapy? And maybe this comes up and there are maybe some persuasive words used. Is that gay conversion therapy? It's a little murky, right?
Well, a therapist is never supposed to have any agenda, whether it's, you know, for the patient, whether they're gay or straight. That's not, you know, they can never sway the patient either way. When I had my first therapy appointment with first therapy with a general psychotherapist, which was very hard for me to trust and be with, you know, I would ask questions like, if so-and-so happened to me, then I must be gay or I must be straight. He goes, I don't know what you are. That's something for you to discover.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what affirmative therapy is letting the person choose their sexuality. Well, not choose in the sense of choosing, but let them discover, you know, if they are going through confusion. The only time, to be clear, so sexuality is not something that's chosen, but there are issues of, like, if there are molested, raped, or abused, like, that is something that is a common issue that the APA will recommend minors to go to therapy for, but they never would say go to something called conversion therapy where there's a specific outcome for the child. So, yeah, a therapist is never supposed to choose what the person is supposed to be. So if a man walks into a therapist's office and says, I hate my life, I'm gay, make me change, the therapist should not say, okay, that, you know, we'll make you straight, it takes this long, it costs this much, and you'll be straight before you know it. Versus what psychotherapy really is about is, okay, why are you upset? What is it that's happening that you're saying you're feeling this way? Where's your anxiety coming from? Is it your religion? Is it religious community, your home community, your parents? Something happened at school? And that's what psychotherapy is about, is having the person deal with their life powerfully.
And Clinton Anderson, does the APA issue any guidelines to therapists about this in particular, about handling kids who come in and are confused over their sexuality?
Well, I think one important distinction to make is between adults and kids, because adults obviously have the capacity to make their own choices, but young people don't. So we don't even really know how many times it's the kids themselves who are having the distress as opposed to their parents or their guardians. And one of the things that psychologists are required to do is even though a young person cannot legally consent, psychologists need to get their assent. So that's one issue there, is are the young people agreeing to this? They shouldn't be being subjected to something that they don't agree to. But as Matthew also pointed out, often they are very close to their parents. They look to their parents, they look to their guardians, they look to their religious communities as important influences, and if those are giving them the message that they're bad, that they need to change, then it's going to be very difficult for young people to get out from under that message, which is why I think the president's actions are so helpful, because his actions will get media attention and people will talk about it, and there will be an alternative message for both parents and young people, hopefully.
Matthew, what made you end the conversion therapy?
I kept, well, my after 3 years, and I was at the end of the first 3 years, I was 19, and my mother and my sisters came back into my life, and they supported me no matter what I went through, and they, you know, it was my mom pushing me to see a general psychotherapist, and I did go through a relapse, which is what most minors who've been through conversion therapy, they believe they failed mm-hmm. the therapy. So I put myself back into it, and by the time I was 21, I finally gave up. I kept running into the same issues with all the conversion therapists, which is I'll never experience what true love is unless I have a child. I'm suffering from a condition, and I can't. And it's my responsibility to find the trauma, and I'm not trying hard enough. And I think the thing that stood out for me the most is that every conversion therapist is a conversion therapist for a reason. You're never going to meet someone who just finished graduate school and gets licensed by their state and go and practice conversion therapy. It's not taught in any curriculum in the country. And every person who's a conversion therapist has a story and something to do with it, whether they themselves claim they cured themselves or they had a gay child. There's some connection that they have. And I never met someone who was just a therapist. And I chose to let go, and I moved back to I was in four different states. I moved back to New York City, and it took me about 2 years to really see general psychotherapists, have mentors, have people who love for me and care for me in life, to have me accept me for who I was, and I came out at the age of 23.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Matthew Shurka. He's an anti-conversion therapy activist. And also Clinton Anderson. Thank you for joining us. Clinton Anderson is a psychologist and director of the LGBT office at the American Psychological Association. And we'd love to know what you think. Should there be a federal ban, not just state bans, on gay conversion therapy? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, new apps that help people film police in public, a lawsuit against Facebook and its facial tagging app, and finally, what we've all been waiting for, new emojis. Tech with Shani Jardin is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A civilian video of a police officer killing an unarmed man in South Carolina went viral this week, and it was that video that led to the arrest of the police officer for murder. This is not the first video of police violence to go viral. And as is the case with most things in life, there's an app for that. App developers are working on and releasing a batch of apps that help civilians take and upload video of police interactions. Details on that and more today in our web roundup with Shani Jardin of BoingBoing.net. Hello there.
Hi, Madeline. It's great to be back.
Nice to have you. Okay, one of these apps is called CopWatch. Mm-hmm. And how does that work?
They launched in 2014, and basically, everybody who has a smartphone has a video camera built into their phone. And I think the point of CopWatch is to upload all of the same kind of video to one shareable database so that, let's say, if multiple people captured one incident, there would be multiple sources of evidence for people who wanted to point out instances of police brutality. But you don't need CopWatch or any particular app like that to make an instantly iconic video go viral.
Right, as we saw this week. You just need your phone.
Oh my God. On the top of the New York Times website the other day, I don't think they've ever done that before. They placed this gruesome video that shows the killing of a man right at the top of the page. It's hard to imagine that 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
I know. And how do you feel about watching that?
I couldn't watch it. I didn't watch it. I know what it contains, yeah. But there are other people whose job it is to watch it, and you know.
Yeah, I watched it.
I don't want to become desensitized to what it contains, which is the documentation of the end of a human life.
Right. Similar problems with watching these ISIS beheading videos as well. I mean, it's a similar...
Yeah. I know like people like Andy Carvin, who was with NPR for a long time, mm-hmm. and was tracking violence in the Mideast, the uprisings in the Mideast. I remember him talking about the kind of PTSD that journalists face in a new way. Journalists who are back home, they're not in the war zone, but they're watching these incredibly gruesome and now widely, widely proliferated images, snapshots, videos, live streams of death.
But do you think the opposite could occur as well, that people become desensitized when they see these videos shot and the same kinds of images shown over and over again and then, of course, repeated on TV and in the news? Is there a way for people to disassociate from it?
I think so. And I imagine that we as a culture will find our own balance of what feels right. I know for myself, early on in my career, I was much more eager to be exposed to this material because I thought I had a responsibility, or that there was some special reason that I should expose myself to that because it's the truth. It is the truth, but you also have to practice self-care.
Yeah. Well, and there are other apps as well.
Yes.
Amnesty International has one.
That's right.
The ACLU has another one.
And you know, the ACLU, they've always been a great source, in my opinion, for advice on how to go about documenting events like what happened in this horrible shooting carefully and with your own safety in mind. I mean, basically, you want to announce to a police officer, if the police officer is looking at you, that you are reaching for your phone, not a gun. Mm-hmm. And if you are ordered to stop shooting, and you're ordered to stop shooting by somebody who has the capacity to shoot you with a gun, you best do that. But it is also important for all of us to remember that the right to film video of police in public spaces is a right that we have in all 50 states. It's an amazing and wonderful right. It's kind of hard to believe that we still have that right. But one of the ways that we protect it is by exercising it.
Right. But that hasn't stopped police officers from forcing people to stop filming, even confiscating the material or arresting them, maybe on something else like unlawful assembly.
We saw that a lot in New York during Occupy Wall Street and in Ferguson. Yeah.
Right. Right. Okay. So let's move on to another part of the legal world. This is a story involving Facebook and someone in Illinois suing them for violating that state's law against collecting biometric data.
Yeah, and this is all about photo tagging. So as anybody who uses Facebook knows, the Facebook service will try to recognize the faces of the people in the photos that you upload and auto tag them for you.
And so it's really good at it.
It's surprisingly good.
Scarily good.
Yeah. But this one man in Illinois doesn't like that and feels like that's a violation of his privacy. So Facebook presumably will argue that you can opt out of that feature. And indeed, you can. If you don't want to be tagged, you don't have to be tagged. But the Illinois law doesn't recognize opt-out. It's basically says that companies such as Facebook should not have the right to do that.
To collect the data in the first place.
Thank you. And it's interesting. Facebook is such a big tech behemoth that they sort of just, you know, like a bull in a china shop. They just break stuff first and ask questions later because everybody uses Facebook. This lawsuit, if it does turn into a class action suit, is the first of its kind that I'm aware of. And, you know, it's interesting. Facebook is bigger than Illinois. I don't know exactly how many people on Facebook, but it's a lot more than exist in the state of Illinois. So does that one state's law mandate how an international service that's used all over the world should be architected?
Or maybe it'll just apply if they win, if the plaintiffs prevail.
In Illinois.
It might just apply only to people who live in Illinois.
And good luck with that.
Right. All right, so on to something that is a little less momentous, or maybe actually a lot more momentous.
This is the big news of the day.
New emojis.
Emoji, yeah.
So now if you download the latest iOS.
iOS 8.3, which I downloaded last night, contains, in addition to, what do they call that, incremental improvements and bug fixes, the classic phrase, also includes a brand new expanded emoji set.
Finally.
About time. And in this emoji set, I'm looking at it right now. I'm gazing down at my phone instead of gazing at Madeline. And when I stick my...
I'm doing an emoji face. You can't see it because you're not looking.
I can pick that face out. So when I stick my thumb on the guy in a turban with bright yellow skin, a little menu comes up, and he can be a white guy, he can be a tan guy, he can be a man with dark skin. Same thing for the old man, same thing for the baby. Oddly enough, oh my God, there's a dizzying array of family configurations. Two guys and a girl, two guys and two girls, two women and one baby, and a man and a woman and a girl. There's like lots of configurations. But the weird thing is they're all bright yellow. They're like Lego people.
Oh, they don't have different races?
Yeah.
So you'd be a yellow same-sex couple?
Right. So you can't have two brown lesbians. And the boy-girl couple, same thing. You can only have bright yellow Lego people. But the cop can be many hues of naturalistic skin tones. Oh, an embarrassed girl. Embarrassed, ashamed girl can be have many different levels of melatonin. That to me is weird. I'll tell you what else is weird. Hello, no tacos under the food section. You've got all these obscure Japanese foods. You've got the shave ice. You've got durian, the stinky fruit that's illegal to eat in public in some places.
Strange shish kebab with the triangle on it.
What is the shish kebab thing? That's like rice. It's delicious. But how many people eat that versus how many people in LA eat tacos? There's no tacos. There's no hot dogs either.
Well, I guess this new emoji app has given and also taketh.
I'm being oppressed.
I think you need to develop an emoji app.
There should be a foodie emoji app. I am developing this. I'm not going to be available anymore for this show because I'm going to be a billionaire.
Okay. Shani Jardin.
50 Shades of Tacos.
Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. See you next week.
Okay.
And do you have a favorite new emoji? We'd love to see it. Tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, we drink a lot of bottled water in this country, and a majority of it comes from California. So during a drought, do these companies have to take less water from our rivers? Nope. That story after a news update from Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Every year, Nestle, the world's largest food company, pays the San Bernardino National Forest $524. That's the fee Nestle pays for its permit to take tens of millions of gallons of water from springs high in the mountains there, bottle it, and sell it as Arrowhead 100% mountain spring water. The permit to do that expired back in 1988, but the Forest Service, depleted by budget cuts, has not reviewed the company's expired permit or analyzed the local environmental impact of all the water Nestle's been taking. In the meantime, Nestle continues to pipe away the water, bottle it, and sell it back to us. Ian James has been covering this story for the Desert Sun newspaper in Palm Springs, and he's here now to tell us more. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, I said, it's my pleasure, I said at the top that Nestle takes tens of millions of gallons. Is that accurate? That seems like a lot of water.
Yes, that's correct. It varies from year to year, and the company has provided some information about how much water it's used from that source. The permit itself is for a water pipeline in the National Forest, about 4 miles of pipeline that takes the water from these springs in Strawberry Canyon to a tank where it's then loaded on trucks. And so that's what the permit is for those pipelines. The company has a right to this water and has been using it since the early 1900s.
Why does the company have a right to this water?
Well, in California, the system of water rights, the way it works is that a company or a farm or another water user that's been using water from a certain source since the early 20th century often has privileged rights to that source. So because they've been using it for so long, they have that established right. In fact, they've been using this water since around the time that the Forest Service was created in the early 20th century.
Does the Forest Service, though, monitor how much the water the company takes, because as we all know, we're in a drought. And so it would seem that they would want to look carefully at how much water is being taken right now.
The Forest Service says they have not been monitoring the amounts of water removed.
Because?
Well, they say that they have a lot of permits to deal with. There's a big backlog of permits, and that they are now beginning the process of doing an environmental analysis to look at this.
Okay. And you talked to someone who works for the Forest Service. I think his name is Robert Taylor. And let's just hear a clip of tape from him about this very question.
We have a lot to do. There are a lot of expired permits. We get direction from regional office and the Washington office on how to handle our levels of permits. I have 660,000 acres of the National Forest to work on, and I'm just one guy. When it becomes a priority, I'll deal with it.
So he seemed to be saying that this isn't that important to the Forest Service or to him.
Well, the Forest Service says that they are taking up the issue. And as to why this permit hasn't been looked at in a number of years, there were a number of issues that were brought up, including past wildfires in the area that have caused significant damage, need to look at other permits related to power lines and other things like that. And the Forest Service has said that they are going to be doing an analysis now and looking at this permit. This comes after some people, including a former Forest Service employee, wrote critical letters about this, and also after we started asking questions about it.
And that person is Steve Lowe?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, let's hear from him, because you also interviewed him on tape.
So there's no doubt about them having the right to some of the water, but to take all the water, which is basically what happens in the summer, from the drainage is too much for me. I think we need to leave some for the animals and for the plants.
Right. So what happens then in the summertime? Is it really taking all the water?
Well, I actually haven't been there in the summertime. We spent a few hours hiking out to this spot on the creek just a couple months ago, and there was water flowing at that point. And there is a stream gauge downstream from this area that does record flow. And if you look back over time, that flow seems to have been continuing. So it's hard to say, but certainly during summer months, all of these streams in this area tend to have a lot less water in them for the wildlife. And I think that's the big concern of Steve Lowe and some of the other people who have been critical of this issue, is that the Forest Service ought to be doing a better job of looking at what the impacts are on the wildlife in the national park when this water is being taken out.
And what does Nestle say about this?
Well, Nestle says that they have a system through which they are looking closely at their sources of water, and that their use of that water is sustainable, that water continues to flow in the creek, and that essentially it's not a problem. They've also said that they are working with the Forest Service to renew the permit that expired back in 1988.
And let's hear from Larry Lawrence. He's Nestle's natural resource manager at its Ontario bottling plant.
Every one of our sources we look at, we watch water levels, if we're monitoring water levels at those sources, or flows, depending on how they're developed. And we watch those flows, and we manage our water take to those conditions. We look at environmental conditions around our sources as well.
So we are relying on Nestle to do the environmental review of itself?
Well, no one from the Forest Service said that. They just said they hadn't done that type of analysis so far.
So it seems that the Forest Service, for various reasons, it says it's overburdened with other stuff to do, that it has allowed Nestle to do its own environmental review. And that has been satisfactory, I guess, until now.
Well, what the Forest Service has said is that the company has been living up to the conditions of the permit, which essentially involve paying that fee each year. And the permit up until now doesn't include a provision that says that there ought to be an examination of what the impacts of the water use are. But I think what people like Steve Lowe are calling for is, especially during drought, that there be a tougher look by the Forest Service at what this and other types of pipelines, when they draw away water from the national forest, what are the impacts? That's a study that hasn't really been done in a lot of areas by the Forest Service.
Right, because it's not just in the San Bernardino Mountains. These bottling plants occur all over the state.
Right. This is a pretty unusual situation in that Nestle is using water from a national forest. Nestle actually says this is the only area in which the company does that. It does also have an agreement with the Cucamonga Valley Water District to use another source of water that also comes from the San Bernardino National Forest. and they have an agreement to purchase that water from the public water agency.
So how does California, I don't know if you know this, compare to other states when it comes to monitoring the water being taken by bottling companies?
Well, there are 108 bottling plants in California, and no state agency is tracking exactly how much water is used by bottling plants in California or monitoring the effects on ecosystems statewide. So what there is essentially a system that's looking, in some cases, piecemeal at what these effects are.
And California is a pretty big player when it comes to bottled water, right?
There are a lot of companies working in various areas of the state. Even in the desert, there's a company bottling relatively small amounts of water in Borrego Springs, which has major problems with its aquifer declining. And there are other companies that are producing brands like Sparklets, Crystal Geyser, Niagara Bottling. So they're all over the place. And some of the sources are municipal water. Sometimes they're pumping their own water from wells. And then in other cases, there are these natural springs, such as Nestle's.
And the fact that California, until recently, didn't really have any strict oversight over groundwater pumping, that has encouraged water companies to come in and pump the water and sell it?
I don't have any indication that the relative lack of regulation of groundwater in California has made it more attractive to bottled water companies. There are a couple of things that are important to point out. One is that a lot of the bottled water that's produced in California is also sold here. And so there's the population here, and there are the sources of water that supply it. Another point is that only about 1%, and this is a USGS estimate, only about 1% of California's total water use goes to industries. And of that, bottled water is a very small piece of it. So in the big picture, bottled water is quite a small water user. But what people like Steve Lowe and other people such as Gary Ernie, these former Forest Service employees, what they're concerned about is these local impacts. Even though in the big picture it may not be a huge amount of water, depending on how it's taken and where it's taken from, there can be impacts to wilderness areas.
So from what I understand, since your story was printed, the Forest Service has decided to do a review of Nestle's permit?
The Forest Service told us while we were working on the article that they were beginning an environmental analysis, and that was after some letters had been written to the Forest Service in the past several months. And that analysis is apparently moving forward. We don't know much about what stage that's in, but the company has said that they're working with the Forest Service to renew their permit. And also, the permit that the Cucamonga Valley Water District is using to sell water to Nestle, that permit also expired a number of years ago. So the Forest Service says it's contacting that water district to look into a renewal.
Ian James, environment reporter for the Desert Sun newspaper, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And Warren Olney is here now to give us a sneak peek into the offerings at 1 o'clock.
We're going to have an offering about the saga of ISIS. You know, about a year ago, all of a sudden everybody was saying this is the most dangerous terrorist group in the world and the one that is the most risky, not only in the Middle East, but elsewhere. And now we've been seeing a spate of stories about how ISIS is in trouble. Well, it turns out it's very difficult to make that case, or a lot more difficult than you might think. Reading such publications, for example, as the Economist magazine, it's quite dramatic. I was really very surprised to find what we did. In terms of what we've heard about the sort of counter-narrative about ISIS, which has been fairly popular and pushed in a lot of places. But when you start talking to people who are in the region and who are knowledgeable about it, ISIS looks pretty tough, continues to look pretty tough.
Despite some setbacks into Crete.
Yeah, although there's some exaggeration of that one, we're told by Rod Nordland of the New York Times, because, first of all, they haven't really completed the cleanup that they said they were going to start doing a week ago. And secondly, there was nobody left in Tikrit. The residents had all departed. But there's other areas that there are areas where they're having a problem. There's no question about it, and their money resources, for example, are reduced. But in other ways, they're still around.
Okay, that conversation, vital conversation at 1 o'clock on To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you.
Okay.
And coming up on this program, here at home, LA's city attorney says he's shut down 500 pot shops, but really, no one knows how many there are. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. City Attorney Mike Feuer says that more than 500 pot shops have been closed down in L.A. in the last 2 years. This after Proposition D was passed in 2013. It imposed stricter standards on medical marijuana dispensaries. Among the new requirements, they couldn't be open after 8 p.m. or be within 1,000 feet of a school or have any kind of lighting, like a neon sign, that's on during non-business hours. Dispensaries that did not adhere to those and other standards were targeted and shut down. What's unclear still is how many pot shops are open in the city. Joining us now to talk about this is Emily Alpert-Reyes. She covers City Hall for the LA Times. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And Bridget Freisteller, Principal Investigator of UCLA's Medical Marijuana Research Project. Welcome to you, Bridget.
Thank you, Madeline.
First, Emily, the city attorney, Mike Feuer, he just held a press conference earlier today. And what did he say about this?
Yeah, he announced that more than 500 medical marijuana shops had been closed since they started enforcing Proposition D, including some that had been shut down before they could actually open, ones that were kind of planning to open that they said that they had managed to convince them that they couldn't.
And how did they shut them down?
It was a combination of things. Civil cases, criminal prosecution. They've also sent out warning letters, letting landlords and the businesses themselves know that they don't meet the requirements of Proposition D.
And then they're also cracking down on other ways, I understand. There's an injunction against a pot farmers market and some smartphone apps.
Yeah. So, you know, as we've seen sort of these new ways that people are trying to find to deliver medical marijuana, there was this pot farmers market that was arranged in Boyle Heights last year that the city attorney got a court injunction against. There's also a smartphone app named Nest Drop that's been used to arrange pot deliveries, and they've gotten court injunctions against both of those.
How are they able to do that if their jurisdiction is only LA City?
I believe it's within the city of LA.
Right. So if you are in a neighboring town that's in the county, you could still have this app?
You know, I'm not exactly sure.
Right. So did he say how many pot shops there are in the city?
Well, this has been the million-dollar question. Obviously, you know, it's something that we don't have really good numbers on, in part because it's not like there's a central registration system. There isn't, you know, the city doesn't legalize them, right? So they don't, you know, provide any kind of way for them to register. Except through taxes, which I'll get to in a minute. But so it's been really unclear. Before the law was passed, police were estimating that there were 700 of them out there, but there were other estimates that put the number, you know, more than twice as high. There is some hint that we can get through tax filings. So more than 1,100 medical marijuana businesses have registered at some point to pay taxes. The city believes that number is probably way in excess of how many actually are operating because, you know, they may not come back to the tax office and say, hey, we shut down, you know, take us mm-hmm. off your list. However, you know, businesses that are paying taxes annually have to file a renewal. And the renewals have been around, this year it was about 415 businesses renewed to pay taxes under the medical marijuana code.
And any idea how much money the city's getting from these taxes?
Oh, shoot. I've reported that before, and I don't have the number off the top of my head. But at any rate, I mean, that number around 400, which I think is consistent with what Bridget has seen in her research, is, you know, three times higher than the number of pot shops that the city has estimated should be eligible to avoid prosecution and stay open under Prop D.
Wow. Okay, so Bridget, let's bring in you. Is that 400 number on top of the 500 that were just closed over the last 2 years?
Well, I think that number, the 400 number, is what's currently open and operating right now. So if they've been closing dispensaries in the past 2 years, the 500, then what's either happening is dispensaries are reopening in other places, or new dispensaries are opening to replace those that have been closed.
And why is it so difficult to track them?
Well, I think Emily talked a lot about that, about how difficult it is. There's not a central registration system. It's also some of the dispensaries that we've been going back to over the past couple of years for our research, they no longer are advertising in any of the typical locations that you'd seen dispensaries in. For example, weedmaps.com or in advertisements in the LA Weekly. What's happening is now that they've got sort of their clientele, you know, the population that keeps coming back, they just sort of only accept people via word of mouth. And so if that's the case, then it's hard to get a handle on where these places actually are.
Yeah. But so you actually go out and physically count them?
We do. So I have a team of about five research assistants who go out every day, generally in the month of September, you know, every other year, and go to all the locations where we have, you know, any indications there was a dispensary that had been open there or, you know, is still open and operating, and they go to all those locations to do a premise assessment, basically. Are they still open? What's going on? Can they get inside? What can they see? And then they also, if when they're driving around the entire city, they see a place that's not on the list, they stop and they'll look at those as well.
So this is a big city. That must be quite an endeavor, trying to keep track of all these.
Yes, and they have a lot of stories that they could tell you someday.
Oh, I want to hear them. Well, so what does your research show in terms of where they locate, and do they actually increase crime, as some people think?
Well, so we've got a couple of things that are going on. What we're noticing in the city of Los Angeles is that there's a shift of where the dispensaries are located. So we used to see a lot more dispensaries located in the valley. Those seem to be moving. You have a lot more dispensaries open in South LA than you did back in 2007, and even back in 2012 when we last did our premise assessment. In terms of crime, the jury is still out on that. Our first study that we did in Sacramento found no relationship between density of dispensaries and crime. We now have another study that we're completing in the city of Long Beach because they had a lot of dispensaries that they closed down in 2012. And it looks like if you have a higher density of dispensaries in neighboring areas, then you're going to have higher crime rates in your local area. So having them adjacent to you looks like it might increase local crime.
Why is that?
Well, we think it might have something to do about where populations are spending time and their comfort with these locations. And so there's a theory, routine activities theory, that says you need the convergence of three things: a motivated offender, a likely target, and absence of guardianship. At the dispensaries themselves, they tend to have, you know, lots of guardianship going on. But
what does that mean? Security?
Security, exactly. And so what's happening is if, you know, they have lots of security local, then the people right there aren't at risk for crime. But as you move further away from dispensaries, then those people could be more at risk for crime, for being victims of crime or having property crime happen in those areas.
Well, is this a chicken and egg thing that dispensaries are located in kind of sketchy neighborhoods to begin with, or do they bring the sketchy?
You know, it's interesting. When you look at the initial studies that have been done looking at where these dispensaries are located, they're not located in the same areas that, say, for example, lots of liquor stores are. So they're not in areas with lots of disadvantage, lots of problems, high minority populations, you know, things that are often also correlated with high crime rates. They're not located in those areas. They might be moving towards that as there's a breakdown in these other areas, but initially they weren't located there. So that's one of the reasons why we've been trying to look at this over time and see, as the locations of these dispensaries change, are you seeing corresponding rates in crime?
All right. Bridget Freisteller, principal investigator of UCLA's Medical Marijuana Research Project, and Emily Alpert-Reyes, cover City Hall for the LA Times. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Myers.
Hello. Here were the feedback.
Here you are. Yet again.
Every day. Today we talked to a man who spent 5 years in conversion therapy. This is the kind of therapy that attempts to change the sexual orientation of gay people. Mm-hmm. If you missed the top of the show, Daniela called in and said that conversion therapy should absolutely be banned on a federal level.
I believe that this is still a practice used by therapists in this country. I think it's really damaging to clients and can have significant impacts that really make people feel even worse than they already do and can be really confusing and cause long-term damage.
Which is pretty much what we heard
right.
from our guy at the top of the show. Elsewhere in the show, we talked about the new crop of emoji. Finally, we have diverse options when it comes to the faces. Hispanic fireman, Asian flamenco dancer, Black Santa. All options now, which is exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited about it. I spent some time messing around with it this morning, and there's some cool stuff in there. Except if you try to send one of these emoji to someone who hasn't updated to the new iOS on
like
their
me.
iPhone, like you, for instance. Let's say I sent you a Black Santa, which is actually something I did earlier. It actually shows up on Madeline's phone as a white Santa and an alien head icon, which is like such a total facepalm for me. Like, come on, guys.
What are they saying with the alien face?
I mean, I think it's just it's supposed to signify a does not compute type thing, but I feel like they could have made a little bit of
but
an
if
effort
I receive
to be a
that,
bit sensitive.
I have no idea what you're saying.
Well, now
me.
You do, because
now
I filled
I
you in feedback. Listeners, still outraged about the taco emoji.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Jolie Myers. And I would like to inform all of our listeners that you are now our managing producer.
Ooh.
Congratulations to you.
Thank
so
you
excited
so much.
That you are now running the show.
Yes.
So hallelujah for that. All right, Warren Olney is leading the show at 1 o'clock, and that's in a few minutes from now. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.